You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. My name is Miranda King, and I'm the program producer here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Through fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programs, the Library Foundation strengthens and promotes greater awareness of the Los Angeles Public Library and its essential services. Inspired by the teen protagonists of We Run the Tides and my favorite activity when I was their age, reading, I'd like to talk for a moment about one of the programs the Library Foundation supports, Summer with the Library, part of the Reading Challenges program at the Los Angeles Public Library. Reading Challenges aim to inspire and motivate Angelenos to participate in year-round reading, literacy, and learning through themed programming and engaging activities. The next challenge begins June 7th and goes to August 7th, but you can begin registering online now from the library's website. Programs will be completely virtual this year, and there are prizes for all sorts of participation. Please visit lapl.org/events for more information. We are 13, almost 14, and these streets of Sea Cliff are ours. We walk these streets to our school perched high over the Pacific, and we run these streets to the beaches, which are cold, windswept, full of fishermen and freaks. We know these wide streets and how they slope, how they curve towards the shore, and we know their houses. So begins Venda La Vida's most recent novel, We Run the Tides. Venda La Vida's writing deftly evokes the feeling of freedom so often associated with youth, to be at the beginning of the rest of your life, to explore, to grow your own view and understanding of the world through experience. It's a beautiful novel, and we're extremely pleased to have Venda La Vida here today to discuss her work with the photographer and filmmaker Autumn DeWild, who is attached to and working with Vendela on a movie adaptation of We Run the Tides. Venda La Vida is the award-winning author of 6 books, including Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name and The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty. She is a founding editor of The Believer and co-editor of The Believer Book of Writers Talking to Writers and Confidence, or The Appearance of Confidence, a collection of interviews with musicians. She was a founding board member of 826 Valencia, the San Francisco Writing Center for Youth, and lives in the Bay Area with her family. Autumn DeWild made her narrative feature film debut with the Academy Award nominated Emma in 2020, after a decades-long career of creating iconic images for artists through her portraits, album covers, music videos, commercials, books, and films. Through intimate collaboration with each of her subjects, DeWild has helped define the visual identity of an ever-expanding pool of notable talent, which includes Beck, Elliot Smith, The White Stripes, Jenny Lewis, and Florence and the Machine. She's the author of several photography books and has written and directed fashion films for Rodarte and Prada. With Emma, DeWild ignited her distinct style of visual storytelling, and I'm so excited to see what she and Venda La Vida will bring to each other's work in their upcoming collaboration. Please join me in welcoming Venda La Vida and Autumn DeWild. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for that lovely introduction, Miranda, and thank you to Aloud and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And hi, Autumn. Thank you,
hi.
Autumn, for being here. Autumn is in London, where it's 1 o'clock in the morning, so she wins some sort of prize. I'm not sure yet what it is, but you won.
I feel so cool. Yeah. Well, I'm also so honored to be here because I'm a huge fan of yours and of this book, obviously. And I'm obsessed with, I've always been so obsessed with teen movies and teenagers in general. So this book plus your voice really, thrilled me. And you and I have had a lot of talks about this, and I think it's really great. I'd love for you to share, how this book started. And also I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, Autumn. I also, I'm a huge fan of Autumn's work, so it's so exciting to be talking with her. And I'm so flattered again that she stayed up till 1 a.m. I never stay up till 1 a.m. So I started this book about 4 years ago, the day after Trump won the election. And it started as a nonfiction book about lies, and I was just became obsessed with lies and the pollution that lies and spread throughout a community. I don't think it was a coincidence that was the day after the Trump election, but I worked on a nonfiction book for about a year about lying and what the nature of lying, why people lie. And then I decided after about a year of working on it that I wanted to switch to making it into a fictional fictional exploration of lying. And I thought, who better to encapsulate lying than teenage girls who are by their very nature, you know, shapeshifters and trying on new identities. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that's the time you're going to try on new identities. That's when you should do it as a teenager. I think the issue is when you stop, you don't stop lying. When you become an adult, that's when issues can start. But
I think that the what's so great about this book is that I think that it really shows you, like you were saying, how it isn't, some lies are important, you know, you know, pretending, using your imagination, you know, when you're that age to imagine yourself as other people or the possibilities of what you could be. You know, unfortunately, a lot of imagination for young girls, I think, is used in self-loathing, you know? So I think what I like about this book is that it has a lot to do with the fascination. There's a wanting, you know, in Ulibi and her fascination with the Maria Fabiola creates an atmosphere of, I think, a desire, I think, mm-hmm. to create a more interesting life. And is it maybe to keep Maria Fabiola, you know, interested, you know?
Yeah, so yeah, Maria Fabiola is Ulibi's best friend, the narrator from the time they were in kindergarten. She thinks she knows her so well, and she's really feels powerful when she's with Maria Fabiola and the other girls. And that's why the book starts in the first person plural, like we do this and we do that, kind of this bravado. Yeah. She's so proud of it. And I knew when I started the book that the we would eventually turn into an I, as there's some, you know, as Ulibi gets ostracized from her friends for not collaborating a lie that they all go in on, which she sees as, you know, believes is a lie about something that happens on the way to school one day. And I think you're right to talk about the wanting as it, when you're that age. As a teenager, you want so much, but you don't even know what you want. And I try to encapsulate that a little bit. I think there was a line in there of like, they want to want love. Like there's just, they don't even know what love is, but they want to have love.
I totally remember that. Like I would picture sort of ridiculous things like holding hands with someone and someone, you know, a guy whispering in my ear, but they were disjointed, almost like puppet shows, you know, of like love and sex, you know? Yeah. And I think also what's really great about this is it's sort of, I think that lying, you know, it can be, very much can be an addiction, mm-hmm. you know, and there's such a similar path, you know, there's some people who have like one drink or two and, you know, and other people who can't stop drinking, you know, and I think lies are like that too. And I've told you this before, but, Ben Gibbard, from Death Cab for Cutie told me, he's like, I don't know what I was so upset about in my 20s, but I remember every single fucking person that hurt my feelings in high school.
it's such a sensitive time, right? And the lies always relate to other things, because it's like, I mean, that's why the expression like avalanche of lies comes, and you are lying to protect yourself, and because you know you do remember everybody who hurt your feelings, and you're lying to protect your image, whatever that image is you have yourself. I love that puppet show, you know, idea you have of love and your you're puppet show, but you. How you think of yourself, right? You're always trying to seeing what you might be appearing like to others at that age. And I think that I once knew this liar when I was in grad school. He said the problem with being a liar is you have to have a really good memory, because you have to remember all your lies, right? Because you get so entangled in it, and that's what people are always waiting for, someone to get caught in their lies. It's like in a Patricia Highsmith novel or something, just because you want. There's like that suspensefulness, will they get caught? And I thought about that a lot when I was writing this book about like, will the people who are lying get caught in their web of lies, or what's going to result from this?
And I also feel like that volume, like, you know, volume can make the sting of each lie, maybe, you know, like the more you pile on, then, it, you know, then maybe the you don't feel that sting as much as the first time that you sort of almost get caught, you know, or get caught.
Right.
I was wondering about, like, I'm always curious what, I know that, you know, the inspiration that you just told us about, you know, Trump, and I do kind of love that that goes from Trump being elected to teenage girls. Like, that really makes sense to me. I was just curious because I'd love to know what your like random inspiration. I'm always curious, like, mm-hmm. not just the sort of direct route into a book, but anything that is like even just like a sniff of it or a breath of it, a moment of that, you know, mm-hmm. not a direct correlation to, but I love that. Would love to know.
Yeah, that. Such a good question. Because, you know, I don't really know. When I started writing this book, it started with the rhythm in my head, even that first sentence that Miranda read, we are 13, almost 14, and these streets are thick with our art. And I didn't know where I was going necessarily with that, but I kept writing. I knew I was onto something and had the rhythm in my head and just canceled my plans for that day because I wanted to keep writing until I lost, you know, so I didn't lose the rhythm. But then, there are these inspirations that kind of like find their way into a novel. And sometimes it's things you're reading at the time. Like I was reading Edith Wharton's Custom of the Country at the time when mm-hmm. I was finishing this book, and that really influenced it. I loved her, the way she satirizes wealthy culture. And that's why I named a lot of the schools. And in the book, after her characters, like Sprague is one of her, my favorite characters of hers is Undine Sprague. So the school that the girls go to is called the Sprague School. And there's a Olenska School of Dance, and there's a Viner competing school called Viner. So I just had a lot of fun, you know, just as a writer, you're just trying to make things fun for yourself sometimes, amuse yourself. And she really found her way into this book. But other things found their way in that I didn't even mean to. Like I looked at the ending of 400 Blows a lot of times, like over and over again, when I was trying to write the ending to the first section of the book, which ends in 1985. And I knew the feeling I was going for. And I'm curious if this ever happens to you, but I knew what I wanted to feel like, and I wanted to feel like the end of childhood. And I knew that that movie encapsulated that for me for a boy, but I didn't know, I was trying to figure out how to put that in words. And so all I could do is like watch it a lot of times. And then the other inspiration was Florence and the Machine's album, High as Hope. And I was found myself, you know, sometimes you get superstitious. So I was working on the book one day and writing, I thought, getting a lot done. And so I kept listening to Hunger, South London Forever, Big God and Sky Full of Song, over and over again, just like a loop, those four songs. And then you made a beautiful music video. I didn't know you then, but you made a beautiful music video of Big God, of Florence and the Machine's Big God. And I was wondering, I just love that video so much. And for those of you in the audience who haven't seen it, please don't watch it right now, but like afterwards, after the conversation, please go watch it, because it's an incredible music video. And it just takes my breath away every time. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about, I'm curious about if you can talk about that video and also what your inspirations are when you're working, whether it's on Emma or on music videos.
Yeah, I have like this weird thing that I started a long time ago. It might be because when I was a kid, we had one of those cottage cheese ceilings. And I wanted it to be smooth so bad, but I knew
everything. Was it white or beige or what was it?
It was dirty, you know, because it was like a really old house. And there was a section missing that was like, you know, maybe a continent, you know, size piece missing of it, you know. But I daydreamed a lot into the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so I have this system of, I lie down and I like you said, with the repetition, I'll listen often to one song, like one time, sometimes I'll just listen to Bolero, you know. If anyone else in the house would be like, oh my God, stop, you know. Because things start floating over my head, ideas, mm-hmm. random, disconnected ideas. And
are they images or like,
yeah, I think they're
very visual thinker. So
yeah, I'm very visual. And then suddenly like three things that would have seemed like they don't belong come together, you know. And for Big God, I was thinking about like, well, first of all, that song is about a guy not texting you back, which I think is hilarious because mm-hmm.
I didn't actually put that together. Yeah.
That is how, I didn't know it until she told me, and it's public knowledge. You know, she did say it in interviews and stuff, but that's That is, I think one time I used the term teen volcano for the teenagers in your book. You know, those kind of things when you're obsessed with someone and you're like, why won't you fucking call, you know, why won't you call me back? You seem to like me, you know, and you start becoming this insane person. And she wrote a song that perfectly, and, you know, and I think like, I guess what I wanted it to be was a couple things. One was I thought all of those girls were all from inside her. So all the girls that we cast as the dancers, it was like she was all these different possibilities of who she was, right? And so it was almost like her, it was definitely very witchy, you know, and witch inspired. But I was like, what if they were all like, you know, part of her soul, right? And these fractured pieces, which is sometimes how you feel when you're losing control like that, right? You know, obsession, love, you know ego, pride, you know, all those things. And then this is kind of separate again, was I was like, you know, I'm obsessed with space. I'll watch anything that takes place in space, but I was like, why is it always the same colors, you know, except for Kubrick's red, of course, boom. But so I was like, what if it's a, you know, why can't it be colorful? And so I was, you know, I really loved, you know, when I was younger, this is a long story, I guess. Sorry, this is what my process, I guess, is long and fractured, but I was obsessed with that trick of the water. You know, I'd always wanted to use it. It's something that
in the video, they're all kind of in like a mirage of water almost. It looks like
it's in Under the Skin, it's in Stranger Things, but it was actually, I think, created, which is when I first saw it, to photograph cars.
Oh really?
Because it looks, if nothing's moving, it looks like a perfect mirrored surface, which you could never get a piece that big, you know. Anyway. That's boring technical stuff, but you know,
that's fascinating.
So all those things together, and Florence wanted to dance, you know, wanted it to be choreography. And so that was established in the beginning. But I think like what was cool about it was that I think the dancers started because of Florence's wholehearted participation in the process. I think they did feel like they were an extension of her. She let them in. I think the magic of it is what she allowed to happen. She let them in, she let them become a part of her, so it was like these tendrils, you know, coming out of her. And I think that's my long, I mean, you wrote a whole book, that was just one video, sorry.
I like her use of the word magic, because I think that sometimes people, like, there is some magic that you just feel happening in some films sometimes. And like, I'm sure as a director, I mean, even as a writer, sometimes you find, you know, connections that you didn't know were there, things are pointed out to you, and you're like, oh, that's like this magic.
Yeah.
You know, magic, for lack of a better word. But I'm wondering, like, was there anything fortuitous or magical that happened when you were shooting Emma? Like something that felt like magic to you?
A lot.
Yeah.
Emma was my first film, but, you know, I've been doing all these, you know, videos and commercials and photo shoots for many years. And over the years, I was like, okay, you know, I worked with very sensitive artists in the beginning, especially, you know, Elliot Smith and Beck, and sensitive in a great way, you know. Yeah. And
I would not trust an insensitive artist. I just don't think those words would go together, but
yeah, I don't know. It's so true. Yeah. And so I realized how important it was, the whole team, everyone on the crew, like you know, great dinner parties are rare, where it really feels like, oh my God, I'm so glad I was here. And I feel like that's a lot down to the host and how you put it together and how comfortable you make. I don't know, it's weird, I'm comparing this to a dinner party, but.
No, it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so the magic was that I was very careful about, you know, the chemistry of the crew, the chemistry, not just of the two lovers, but also of all the other actors. And it was like putting a giant, like, you know, the best party in the world, you know, I was trying to come up with, you know, and I think what happens is that the magic was that everyone was working for the common good. They were so excited to see each other. They're excited to see the progress, you know, Anya at the helm, of course, Anya Taylor-Joy, you know, is an incredible actor, but besides that, she's also, she doesn't want to be alone in that greatness. She wants, she makes other actors, she helps other actors be great, you know, and then, and that. So for me, that was the biggest magic, was seeing this thing I'd planned for so many years. Like, yeah, it does matter, you know, who the assistants are, and it, and learning how to lead and encourage people in a way that's, you know, firm, but, you know, like, you know, so you have like a great ship, you know, becoming a great captain. So, but yeah, there was a lot of, I guess the most witchy magic was that Anya actually got a bloody nose.
That is witchy.
That's our witchy vibes was, and also, you know, I've said this a lot, but the bloody nose is in there because I, my body has failed me on some of the most romantic experiences of my life. I'm so human, you know, and that was important to me to put that in. Cause you can't say she couldn't have gotten a bloody nose in 1814. But I think that what was funny was that in the morning she sent me a video and she's like, with a video like, oh, guess what? Emma's possessed my soul. I got a bloody nose. I looked at the video and then I got a bloody nose.
Oh my gosh.
And then when we were on set doing that scene, she got a real bloody nose. And I have to say that it was total chaos and it was the funniest thing and it was incredible. So yeah.
That's amazing.
Sorry, I'm talking too much about me. I want to talk.
I asked you. I'm learning things I never knew, of course. This is really fun. We should always have conversations at 1 a.m. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of do. while I'm in London. I wanted you to read, I'd love for you to read aloud a piece of the book. And I think like you and I were talking about, I mean, I love the scene where she goes to the concert. And so how would you feel about doing that?
Bendelina? I feel good about it. Yeah, I'll do it. okay, so this is a scene when the protagonist, Eulabie, goes to a concert with a boy that she likes named Keith. And the concert, the tickets and everything, the concert's to a psychedelic furs concert. And she has a Swedish au pair who's staying with her. It's not her au pair, but Eulabie's mom is Swedish. And she kind of takes in all the au pairs who aren't getting along with their families. So this au pair shows up one night in the middle of the night, knocking on the door, two suitcases. And
Eulabie, I like this au pair rescue service.
Yeah, basically au pair rescue service. And so she ends up staying with Eulabie and her family, becoming definitely a confidant to Eulabie and a good force in her life. And she procures these tickets to the psychedelic fur show and drives in there. Eva drives us to the show in my parents' yellow Saab. Keith and I are quiet on the drive and Eva fills the air by talking about how popular heavy metal is in Sweden. We pull up in front of the Fillmore. The crowd is thick and older. She's cool, Keith says, and Eva drops us off. Yeah, I say. I love that he likes her. The scent of damp fallen leaves hits me as we enter the building. Hot, Keith says. Right, I think. The only other concert I've been to is Duran Duran. We're standing in the middle of the theater, not knowing what to do with our hands. Everyone else around us has drinks in theirs. When the concert starts, we sway a little to the music. No banter, Keith says. What, I ask? Leaning into him, I smell Tide. His mother must not dilute the laundry detergent the way my mom does. Interesting that there's no banter from the band, he says. Not even, it's so great to be in San Francisco. A relative newcomer to this world, I say, yeah. The band starts playing Heaven, and Keith begins spinning around with his arms stretched up in the shape of a V. What are you doing, I ask. That's what Richard Butler does in the video for this song. I know better than to ask who Richard Butler is. I never thought of learning of any of the names in the band. Try it, he says. I start spinning, reluctantly at first. Stretch your arms up and out, Keith suggests. I do. And there we are, spinning, circling in opposite directions so that our hands gently collide with each rotation. Each time we face each other, I see that Keith is singing the lyrics. I succumb to the music. I soar up above the world and nothing else matters except seeing Keith's face again on the next rotation when I get another whiff of Tide. I'm so happy we came to the concert, I say. What, he says, trying to hear me over the music. I'm so happy, I yell. When the first finish their first set, finish their set and leave the stage, my heart drops. But then everyone shouts for an encore, me included, me especially. And the band comes back out and plays Pretty in Pink. I scream because now I know what it feels like when the music stops. And I desperately don't want it to end. And the scene goes on a little bit from there. But that's a scene that that's a scene when someone pointed out to me that the book is called We Run the Tides. And obviously Keith, there's a couple references to the fact that Keith's mom watches his clothes tied. Oh, yeah. It was a German translator who pointed it out to me. And I thought that was really interesting, the way that I hadn't even thought about that. I just thought about it as a detergent. And my whole point of using that was to show that Ulibi's family is like much stingier. You know, they never turn on the heat. And they like, the mom dilutes the detergent to save money. And so of course it's like the strong scent of Tide that's not diluted is going to be kind of an overwhelming sensation to her. But I didn't realize the correlation until she pointed it out, which is kind of fun. I love it. But I love it when there are things like that, that, you know, you didn't mean to have happen, but they're there in the book.
I love, you know what I love about that is that the way you write, I can see I can see more than what you've written, which, you know, in music, that's sort of like a great drummer knows when not to play the drums. I don't know. And I think what I love about that is the way you've written it is I can tell when he's close to her, and that's so unusual for her. You know, like I imagine, you know, to have a boy, you know, for any of us that have, you know, had magical experiences at rock shows, which I miss very much right now, that first lean in where you have to talk a little bit loud and his nose is near your ear, his or her, you know,
really smell too, right? You're like, you're so ready to hear music. So you notice that you know, it might smell like pot, like damp leaves, because she doesn't really know if it smells like pot or what the smell is, and the smell of his tide. And yeah, you're like, your senses are all kind of turning on at the same time.
Yeah. And I love the way you've incorporated smells. Someone else who interviewed you brought that up, and I saw. And I think that I don't know. I guess I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit. That's, you know, nice. Bringing the senses in different ways as a writer. Is that something that rules? You know, is it, how much of a plan do you have for these kinds of how much does that go in as you go back over, or is it?
It's usually there in the beginning. The smells are usually there. I have a very sensitive nose to everything, but I also think that I feel like smell, I wrote this piece for Slate many years ago about how fiction had become deodorized. You know, there were very few mentions of the smell that I was finding in books. And the more I became aware of it, the more I started using smell. Cause I think it's so, it really makes you feel like you're there if you can describe the scent the correct way.
Yeah.
And I started doing a lot of history about the history of smell, and you know, the world used to be a lot smellier, obviously, before we had sewer systems and stuff. And so a lot of literature used to incorporate a lot more smell, usually negative smells, but that's where like that beautiful book, Perfume came out of, just like the scent that the fact that it was so stinky in the outside world, and they didn't have proper drainage or,
and there was arsenic in the wallpaper. I did.
During arsenic in the wallpaper?
I did a lot of research that like a lot of this, like you'll feel better if you go out and get some air, was very real because they were being slowly poisoned.
Oh, was that from Emma? You did that research?
I did. Yeah. I found I wanted to know, like, I sort of obsessively research, and it seems like you do too. Are you?
Yeah, I do.
It seems like research is a joy for you.
Sometimes, sometimes you don't want it to show too much on the page. Like you don't want it to be like, look like you're doing it. Especially when I've written about other countries, I don't want it to look like a travel log, like, but I do want to get a sense that the character is there. So,
well, is that like a weeding out thing, or is it just like, you know, when the detail needs to be in?
I think it's, you know, I always like to, like, I always joke that no one would ever want to see my photos from a trip. Like if I was researching going somewhere to write a book set there, like I've written a book set in Northern Scandinavia, Turkey, Morocco. But when I went to Northern Scandinavia in particular, I took pictures of the most random things, like shower curtains, or the way I came back with 1,000 pictures of the sun because I went there in the winter. So I wanted to show, you know, wanted to label what time each picture was taken, like what the sky looked like at that time. And I would take pictures that back then, especially in Scandinavia, they had phone books. And so I would take pictures of random pages from the telephone books, because I knew I wanted to use character names. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to take one first name, one last name. And so, and I take pictures of sidewalks, like really just I also love taking pictures inside grocery stores, like local grocery stores. And those, like, somehow that always ends up in my books, like some product that you can only get in Turkey.
I think that's so cool.
So that's the kind of research I do.
Now because you're from, you know, this, even though this isn't, you know, even though this is a fictional story, mm-hmm. but, you know, this is where you're from, San Francisco. How much were you digging back into your memories of, like, just as far as time period and San Francisco in the 80s?
You know, I was thinking about it a lot, obviously, but I didn't want to research it. Like, my mother has all my old diaries still at her house for some reason, at their house, my parents' house. And I didn't want to go back and look at my diaries when I was writing this. I didn't want to, like, have it be about me or about that time. I wanted it to be kind of more impressionistic for me. I didn't want it to be my story, but it was, it's amazing. Your childhood is so vivid to everyone, right? You just think about your childhood and you can remember details. And then you try to create a character and think, well, where would they go? And what album would they buy on Haight Street? What would they wear to this party? I think that's the most fun thing, actually, is deciding, like, what someone would wear to a party, especially if you want them to not be comfortable. Or they, you know, it reveals so much about their aspirations versus how other people see them. So, for example, in the book, Ulibi goes to a welcome back party for her friend who's been supposedly kidnapped. She has her doubts about the veracity of the kidnapping, and she dresses in a black and white polka dot dress that she's bought on Haight Street, and it's a bowler hat that she wears because she wants to be like Sabine and Unbearable Lightness of Being, and fancies herself kind of a sexual person like that. And everyone else there is just wearing, you know, their usual party clothes, which are not, you know, not these bold choices. And you sent me a link of, was it Elizabeth Taylor in Winter Kills walking into a party in a red dress when everyone's wearing black and white? And I thought, that is the badass old thing. And I thought, it's such a great moment because everyone knows that feeling. You know so much about her. You know who she's trying to present herself as. You know what everyone's thinking in the room. Everyone else is black and white. And you also, you have so much empathy for her too, because we've all been that person.
I also think that you have this choice as a teenager in those moments to fully embrace, you know, being out of place, or you retract forever, you know, and if you can cross over, then you have changed and there's more possibility suddenly. You're like, oh, I can be the fool and feel fabulous for a moment, even if mostly I felt like I'm an idiot, you know?
Right.
And I think that can encourage you to go the way of the weird, which is what I would encourage most people to do.
Go the way of the weird. I like that.
I have no sense of time, Vandala. So
we're going to start taking questions from the audience in about, I think, 9 minutes.
So. Okay. So we have 9 minutes.
We have 9 minutes. Yes.
I just wanted to point out one of my favorite lines in the book, which is, your grandfather would be so disappointed in you, which now I am going to just yell at random strangers.
Anyone who cuts you off. Yeah.
Yeah. Your grandfather would be so disappointed in you.
Thank you. Ulibi has this idea. Definitely has these ideas about people around her, and she becomes obsessed with this boy who's maybe of Swedish descent, and his last name is Wallenberg. And she thinks that he's the descendant of Wallenberg, who, you know, rescued a lot of, transported a lot of Jews during the Holocaust to Sweden by giving them passports. And she just convinced that he's, you know, the grandchild of this man with no other justification except for these Swedish, and his last name is Wallenberg. And so when this boy at the party does something to her, she says, you know, your grandfather be so disappointed in you. And he's like, what are you talking about? But I do think you're right. That's one of those insults that could really be used. And I think actually put anyone in their place, you know, everyone does have this, like, grandfather. You might have issues. People have issues with their parents or whatever, but a grandfather is always going to have some.
I know. And I feel like everyone that I'm going to yell that to is going to take a moment and be like, you know, maybe for once regret their actions. We'll see. I'm going to try it out.
Test it out. Let me know.
I think another thing that I really love about this book is, you know, they're 13 going on 14, right? Yeah, obviously that's the beginning of the book, tells me. And that's the beginning of, like, you were saying, like, that wanting, you know, where you think you want something sexual to happen. I just think it's interesting how you balance, like, things that are sort of like assault, unwanted, that are, you know, inappropriate, like sexual advances on or even comments to a young girl, but the confusion of being excited for a moment that the attention is on you, and then, you know, it being too late to, like, put the brakes on things. I don't know. I was just wondered if you could talk a bit, you know, because I think it's really important how confusing that is, which is
I think it's really confusing. Yeah. And I think also it's confusing in the 80s and the time period I'm writing about, because no one had vocabulary or language necessarily for what had happened. And so it was very deliberate. There's a scene where something happens to a girl that I think now anyone that happens would have a language, maybe, hopefully, to talk to their parents or their friends about. But then these things just happened, and no one really knew what to make of them. And they're just, it was a very deliberate choice of mine in the book to never comment on it again. And it's also, there's that thing too, where you're that age where you want to, just as lies are passed around and lies can be contagious, I think sexuality can be contagious. So your friend obviously gets to, like, second or third base, and then you think, okay, I should go to the same base, or, you know, all these things get passed around. Or you had this great, great idea at one point where you're talking about, just, I think you were mentioning this, how the girls, like, when they learn how to take off their bras, like, without, you know, like, through their shirts, and how they can just, that knowledge gets passed around almost just silently, you know, like, just,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
the way that, you know, there's so many languages, all the girls that age, and I know, because you had a daughter who's now in her 20s, early 20s, and I have a daughter who's 15, and you just see the way they're, like, you know, watching each other, and just, like, learning from each other, and taking these visual cues from each other.
Yeah.
In addition to cues about sexuality and relationships.
And that ties in so well with the sort of sexist sort of teaching process of, you know, I like that the teacher that only teaches the girls male writers doesn't, I really like that he doesn't know he's sexist, you know, not demonized by you. He's completely ignorant, you know, and I just like that. I don't know if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I really wanted to show in the 80s just how, even in all-girls school, like I'm portraying in the book, I feel like the teaching was very much focused on male writers. And so I have fun with my creating, you know, totally fictionally, I created a character. I always had great English teachers, actually, a character named Mr. London, who keeps it very vague whether he's related to Jack London or not. And he's very young. He's kind of too young to be teaching girls that age, because there's not enough of an age gap. And so they're also confused by that, you know, that he's so young and possibly handsome, but they're not even sure how to interpret that. And he gives Eulaby a bad grade for not liking Franny and Zoe, Salinger book. And, you know, and she's like, I got a bad grade for not liking. And he says, well, Salinger is a genius. And she says something like, well, I'm the ideal audience and I don't like it. And he gives her, you know, a B for her interpretation, which I just thought, wanted to just have a little fun with that era of where I do feel like as young women, then we didn't know even how much of the male gaze was being put upon us and how much we were interpreting that and how much we were reading through that. And I look back at my own reading patterns, even my 20s, and think how much I was unaware of how much I was seeing things through the male
and gaze. how much you thought you were learning about what a sexy woman was, or what a woman who was trouble or a wild spirit was, and that they were these kind of cartoon characters created by men. Mm-hmm. I think there's some questions coming in.
Wow.
Question for both Vendela and Autumn. What has your collaborative process? Oh, I see. There's another one before that. What music were you each listening to in high school?
I was really interested in New Order. I really loved New Order a lot. What else did I like a lot? I liked The Alarm. I think that was before New Order. I am going to keep thinking. I'm just trying to think of all my concert stubs. What about you, Autumn? You must have been very
well. Okay, I was a nerd, total nerd, proudly, but So I had a weird combination. I was obsessed with old movies. So I like had a crush on Bing Crosby. So I knew all the songs from all the old movies, you know, and I loved Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers mm-hmm. while other people were going to punk shows. That's mm-hmm. what I was doing. And then most of my music, like when I found the music I loved, which also meant going back to the 80s and stuff I hadn't heard and stuff, that was more in my 20s when I had roommates who didn't try to outcool me and just really shared, like gave me music education and that was really exciting. And I kind of found, that's when I heard the Velvet Underground, and that's when, you know, I heard all the punk bands I should have heard in the, you know, mm-hmm. in the 80s. But I was very tall. I'm 6'2" and I was getting very tall at the time. And for some reason, your Sweet Dreams, Eurythmics, made yeah. me feel better about being tall, even though she's tall, but not extraordinarily tall. Uh-huh. But I saw that music video and I was like, that's it. I'm not going to pretend I'm not tall. I just was like, that was my...
So, that's amazing. So,
unfortunately, my answer, and I loved Simon and Garfunkel. So I was a bit nerdy, you know.
I love that you also, that music video was so helpful to you. And then you went on to make music videos like that, you know.
I know, you know, and yeah, Annie Lennox just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I hadn't really seen a woman like that, you know.
Yeah.
I saw the Missionary Man tour with, and there was a, at the Greek theater, I think it was, and the giant leather bustier curtain unzipped and she came out.
Oh. That sounds amazing. That was at the Greek. Okay.
I think there's another question. What? Oh, about our collaborative process. We can't tell you that. I mean, I suppose
we'll get back to you on that one.
We'll get back to you on, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of this us talking and laughing. And the one thing I will say is that, you know, Vendel is the writer and I'm kind of like, I come up with bits and tell stories and stuff. And a lot of what I do is a lot of photo research, you know. And one thing I also am really excited about this book is, you know, it's a time travel moment because in 1984, I was 13. So I was, you know, like almost Eulabie's age. And so I'm excited about how different San Francisco, I grew up in Los Angeles, how different, you know, before the internet, you know, if you went to visit a cousin in another city, you came back with something, you know, that was going on there. Like my friend came back from the Catskills and she's like, they're cutting sweatshirts there. This was like Flashdance era, right? You know, before Flashdance came out, and she's like, they're just cutting it off and wearing it. And so we all did it the next day. So I think like, you do that really well. And I, you know, I think it's exciting to, you know, really be able to imagine San Francisco again. You know, there's something that has been lost there. Maybe mm-hmm. you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Well, how much San Francisco also, has changed.
It's not an accident that teenage girls are kind of representing or in this period of change, and the city is going through a period of change in the 80s. And Eulabie even mourns the fact that, you know, everything exciting seems to have happened before she arrived, you know, the 60s and 70s and everything exciting happened.
I definitely felt that way as a teen at that age.
Yeah, I think it's like that sense. And I always have compared this to you before, I said this before, but I think it's like, you know, arriving at a party at the end and you know it was a great party and you've missed it. You can just tell everyone's yeah. like passed out. Pretzels are soggy. The music is like, there's some guy just playing whatever bullshit music he wants to play because no one else cares anymore. And you're like, oh my gosh, I missed the party and I can't even go back. And there won't be anything like this. And that was a feeling I had growing up in the 80s in San Francisco. And I wanted to encapsulate that in the book too, that the girls have this feeling, especially Eulabie, that she's missed everything fun. And then, you know,
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you think it's also because we were coming out of, like, basically the 60s were the rebellion, the sort of wild minds, all of that was very well documented. So, you know, I think when that sort of bohemian era in the 20s happened, you know, the children, grandchildren, you know, there was maybe some photos, but there weren't as much. We were inundated with video content and photographs of how cool everyone was, you know?
Yeah, and great photos too. Like really, like, I feel like high quality photos of, like, that's true. That's an interesting way of putting it, but that also brings me back to the fact that Autumn, I feel like, obviously is a very visual person, so she'll send me a lot of photos, and so this back to collaboration. So I plan to print them out and put them up all over my office wall, so I can kind of try to live in her brain a little bit, as much as you can try to live in anyone else's brain, eyes, I should say. Yeah. So
I think it's interesting how a photo can make two people, two artists talk. I think I could send you a photo and you and I could talk about that one photo for, you know, an hour.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool because, you know, photography, you know, it's a different way in, I think, sometimes to imagining a moment, you know. I mean,
you grew up with that too, because your father is a well-known photographer. So can you talk about that? Were you always like developing photos with him, or was it how did that influence you?
Yeah, I grew up in the dark room. I was always in his studio. And I always looked through his photos when I was, and we didn't really, you know, my mom said, you know, we don't get bored in this family, you know, so. but it's true, because there were so many photos of, you know, of my dad's friends and his scene in the 60s. And, you know, growing up with that photo archive just in boxes, you know, every age that I looked at some of my favorite photos, I had a different understanding of that moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can't get an education like that, you know. I mean, I wish people would sort of go into a library of photos more, because I think, I wish there was more access to people to see a timeline like that. Like, I saw his friends as they got older. I saw, you know, I saw good days and bad days in his photos, because he was a documentary photographer. So I think, like, photos have always, you know, I see connections in different time periods too. I think, like, studying my dad's friend, mom and dad's friends, who were sort of wild minds, and you know, the Marx Brothers and Ty Ty, I like to say, you know, and I think that I could see that same spirit in other time periods and other photos. You know, you start recognizing personality types and not just costumes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I think there's a question here that for me that's been posted twice, so I will. Can't try to answer it. What was the reunion as adult section? Was the reunion as adult section at the end always part of the story? So I don't want to give too much away, but toward the end of the book, some of the girls do meet up again. And that's a great, great question, because it wasn't part of it. I got to the ending of what I thought was the ending of the book. And while the paint was drying, that's when I was, you know, I think that really I was letting it kind of sit. And while the paint was drying, I was reading a lot of Custom of the Country, and I really started admiring the way that Edith Wharton could just kind of skip ahead. She just does a chapter break, and then she skips ahead a few years, and the reader has to catch up a little bit. But I think that it's a really interesting way to show what happens to different relationships and to different character arcs. And I realized when I was reading her, and I thought I'd finished the book, that I wasn't done with the characters yet. And I wanted to show how the same things that put in, you know, the lies in motion, the deception in motion, to see how those played out as adults. So that's a great question. It came late, and I was really excited when I found my way into it. And then when I finished that scene, then I felt like the book was done, you know, and then I knew it was over.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about that section, because I feel like we shouldn't.
Yeah, we won't talk about it.
I don't like spoilers. Someone asked, curious if there are other novel writers, director duos you love, or any other creative pair for that matter. I don't really know. I'm sure there is. I just, do you know?
Of any, you know, I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, this personal thing, my mind was recently blown by the collaboration of Sufjan Stevens and Moses Sumney, for instance. Yeah, I love Sufjan Stevens too. I'm trying to think of, I mean, I have to think about that a little bit more, because I'm trying to think which collaborations I really like. I mean, there are a lot of movies based on books that I really admire.
I don't think I know enough about the process of those, you know, those collaborations to know. You know, sometimes people collaborate and it's feels like a disaster, but they make a beautiful thing, you know.
Right.
I don't really work that way in a destructive manner, you know, but you know, sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of bands like that, you know, that it feels like they might kill each other, and that's maybe where the most exciting music comes from.
Yeah. I think one film we've referenced in talking is The Outsiders, just how real that is as a teen movie.
And yeah, so that is actually
Essie Hinton, who wrote the book The Outsiders, and Francis Ford Coppola had a great relationship, and just really, I really feel like that's such a great teen movie. We'll talk about how they actually cast really, and the casting in that is exceptional.
Exceptional. And I think it's really cool about that too, is that the Outsiders was major for me too at that time. And I think what's cool is that wasn't it a group of teenage girls that wrote to Coppola and begged him to make the movie?
The Outsiders?
Yeah. And then what I also love is that during the making of The Outsiders, on every Sunday, him and Essie Hinton were writing Rumblefish, because they had to sort of get these kids while they were young.
Okay, Matt Dillon. Writing. Yeah, amazing.
Rumblefish also. I totally. Vouch for Rumblefish. Yeah.
Rumblefish was really big in South America too. It had inspired all these filmmakers. There was a documentary about people, like, you know, all these people in South America became filmmakers because of Rumblefish.
I think we have to wrap it up, but I want to ask, who was your crush? Because I just remembered mine was Matt Dillon.
You know, I liked Ralph Macchio, I have to say.
Yeah. Oh my God, Karate Kid. Yeah, I was like, I was embarrassed how much I loved The Karate Kid, but you know, I rewatched it, and I was not wrong about how cute he was.
I just watched it with my son and husband recently, and it was like, yeah, it was really, it holds up.
And Outsiders, oh my God, heartbreaking in that. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, Ralph Macchio and Matt Dillon for me back then.
I wish we could ask the audience who their crushes were in that film, but
we could have talked this whole time about crushes. What are we doing? Book schmuck.
I want to say thank you to so many. I know we didn't get to all the questions. I'm hoping we can meet you in person at some point. And I just want to say thank you to Aloud, the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, Jessica Strand, who originally invited me, to Allie, to Kelsey, to Miranda. And to the audience, thank you for coming out tonight. And a big special thank you to Autumn as well for actually staying up late and having this conversation with me, and for just and wearing a hat too.
I know, in bed. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I'm going to lay right down there afterwards.
But I'll figure it out. Okay, thank you, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out. Have a good evening.
Yeah, thanks so much, you guys. It was an honor to be here. Bye, Vendela.
Bye, Autumn.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.